Good evening. I'm Dr. Linda Esser, your host for this program. Welcome to LIS Radio Class Cast for 9418, coming to you from our studios in the Verizon Room located in Townsend Hall on the University of Missouri Columbia campus. The 9418 Class Cast is a project of the School of Information, Science, and Learning Technologies. This evening, we'll be welcoming Michael Holland, head of the Special Collection. Collections, Archives, and Rare Books for the University of Missouri Columbia. And Mike will be joining us to discuss research using historical documents and artifacts. And then Mike will be taking your questions. The telephone numbers to call are 884-3803 in Columbia or 866-768-5483 toll free. One more time, that's 884-3803 in Columbia or 866-768-5483. And if you have questions about the course, I know we have some minor blog problems. we'll take those after we talk to Mike so we don't make him stick around while we try to solve problems in class. If you have questions about the projects that you're working on or want some information on that, go ahead and give us a call on those because Mike might be able to help. Okay. Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about the kinds of responsibilities that you have at MU as the head of special collections?
Okay. Well, actually, I wear several hats at MU due to personnel cutbacks and staffing cutbacks. I've inherited several areas of activity, and they have been combined under me. I came here about 10 years ago as the university archivist, and I'm responsible for all of the official records of the university campus and the University of Missouri system. I also am now head of the Rare Books and Special Collections Department, which has a fairly substantial rare books component, probably in excess of 40,000 rare books. Special Collections is also one of the areas that I'm responsible for, and that consists of everything from manuscripts of alumni and faculty to collections that relate to the university and the history of the community. I'm also responsible, a fairly new responsibility, is to help coordinate the digital collections that MU is trying to develop and trying to organize at this time.
What kinds of things are in rare books?
Well, we have some truly nice things. Our oldest book is a Latin grammar called Construction, which is a Latin handwritten manuscript dated 1175 A.D. Just to give some context to that, 1175 is about the time towards the end of Henry II's reign in England and just before the beginning of Richard the Lionheart's reign.
Wow. Can't imagine.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to be able to, you know, sit there. It's a true privilege. Although the manuscript itself is not a terribly exciting topic, it's really a incredibly rich source of information about how early books were manufactured, how they were, at the time of early books in manuscript form, there were not paragraph indentations. The way one set off a chapter or a paragraph from one another was with red ink doing a rubrication. There were no page numbers in 1175. They were still too used to finding information as one would on a scroll. So page numbers and certainly indexes were far into the future. But you can see the marks that the illuminists and the manuscript drafters put on the vellum to formalize very standard margins, very standard lines, and you know the types of features that were needed at the time.
So page numbers were actually a technological improvement?
Yes, they were. And very few manuscripts had page numbers. And very many of the early incunabula, the early printed materials for the first 50 years of the printing press, didn't have page numbering either. So it was a different world.
Certainly was. What specific kinds of knowledge and skills do you have or need for the kind of work that you do?
As an archivist, you need to know how organizations work, how they document themselves, how records are created, and how, you know, they serve scholarship. I think you have to have dabbled a little bit in history, certainly the reading or writing, to fully appreciate the kind of records that are the most helpful and need to be saved. In rare books, it's certainly useful to have a background in the book trades. It's helpful to have some knowledge of rare book form and manufacturing. Certainly knowing the technicalities of searching specific books through auctions and bids. And probably most importantly is having some linguistic proficiency with some of the major languages in the collection. In our collection, certainly it would be Latin, followed probably by either Greek or German.
Mm-hmm. Where are my students, for example, likely to find primary source documents regarding the establishment of youth services in Missouri's libraries, or even about the history of Missouri's libraries?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. There are a number of places they can go. One of the first places I would send anybody to start doing some historical research into a library program or a specific library would be the State Library, which maintains a collection of various reports from local county municipal libraries. The university, State Archives is also a holder of some early Department of Education records that deal with both public and school libraries. The place, I think, though, that would probably be the richest is in the local region itself. There are many libraries that that do have their records, their minute books from their boards, even their acquisitions lists, their correspondence, actually saved in the library itself, sometimes in the genealogy and historical area. And sometimes those records are transferred to the local county historical societies. There are also some small collections in other institutions. Western Historical, I believe, has some early public library records from various locations around central Missouri. You just kind of have to try to think, if I was an old file, where would I be? And as silly as that sounds, you don't want to range too far from home, I think, if you're an old file. So I would say the local places are the best places to start.
Okay. I'm writing notes as I go.
Okay.
What kinds of things might they bump into? You know, sometimes there are boxes of papers.
Mm-hmm.
in the basement of the library, and you get the job of cleaning them out. What kinds of things are you likely to just kind of serendipitously bump into that might help with some kind of historical research?
Other than pigeons and bats.
Yeah,
okay. All right, well, just wanted to clarify. You're very likely to find minutes, proceedings of meetings. The the Boston Public Library model came essentially fully formed to Missouri when public libraries began to be formed here, even before the Carnegie period. And most libraries that were supported by public taxpayer money had boards that that governed them,
mm-hmm.
or kind of governed them. There are minutes are the one thing that's usually kept. There are sometimes correspondence between the librarians, the board members, between the librarian, the board members, and the county commission, the source of most income. Those are among the richest sources I think you'll find. There are also, of course, fiscal records. Every library keeps fiscal records for the simple reason that they are also pretty much the documentation of the formation of the collection. Many of the shelf lists, the acquisitions lists that were created early in the part of the 20th century served as both the financial records and also the record of the collection.
So you could find out perhaps what kind of children's materials were being held in a collection by going through those records.
Exactly. I mean, there are truly a lot of bibliometric possibilities in records of local public libraries.
You could even see what percentage of the funds were spent on children's materials as in relation to what was spent on adult materials in
Precisely.
The budget. That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
If they find something that's really interesting or something they think's important,
mm-hmm.
how should they handle it? What do they do with it? Do they just throw it back in the box? Or?
Well, I might, depending on the level of care, if the materials are not well cared for, you might bring it to the attention of the public librarian and suggest some conservation and some attention to the records because it is their history. And I'm sure some librarians would really appreciate that and take action, and others might not want to be bothered. But if you find records that are fairly old, if you find them that are continuous for a good long period of time, they do have historical significance. And if the library itself doesn't want to preserve and process and save the records for the future, perhaps the County Historical Society, perhaps Western Historical would be willing to do that.
Okay. School libraries sometimes will get donations of items that generally fit into the category of I'm cleaning out my basement old books.
Yeah.
How does the school or a public librarian know that they've gotten something that might be a piece of history and that should be kept rather than discarded?
Mm-hmm. Well, once again, probably 95% of the donations to any library are probably books you can neither use nor ones that are particularly rare, and that goes for the university too.
Yeah.
Most of ours are segregated out and saved for sale to patrons. But there are, 5 or 10% that do have some value, either for the general collection or for special collections in rare cases. I think that there are a few rules of thumb for checking out, for assuming value in books. One of them, surprisingly enough, is not age, because there are many books of the 19th and 18th century that while they seem old to us, are not particularly rare. Book production in the 19th century was very robust. Many copies of editions were made, and they're not necessarily valuable just because they come from the 1820s or even the 1790s. The thing I would look for in books of the 18th century would be American imprints, because they're going to be much rarer than British imprints. For the 19th century, imprints from places other than New York and Philadelphia, which were the publishing centers. If you find the products of presses from areas other than those two publishing centers, there's a possibility they may have been produced in small numbers. Also, if you find books that have titles addressing very specific regional or historically defined topics, if you find books on the management of slaves on plantations, if you find books early construction in in particular parts of the country, if you would find materials that address topics like the eugenics movement, things like that that are memories in history, those are a pretty good tip that the book may not be widely available and thus, you know, may have some actual value. I would say, though, that one of the things that makes books so valuable to public libraries and academic libraries is the locality of the publication or the locality of the topic. In cases where there are county histories, small books about local families, the like, those are not going to have wide circulation, nor are they going to have large numbers of publications. And it's very likely one might have, you know, only one of, you know, half a dozen extant copies of a biography of a local grandee or an early history of the county.
Mm-hmm.
So those are certainly things I would keep my eyes out for.
Okay. Kind of running through my list. If an organization is keeping records of its activities for historical purposes, mm-hmm. and they're going to take them to Western Historical Manuscripts Collection,
mm-hmm.
What kinds of things should the organization, you know, be thinking about keeping and taking to the Western Historical Manuscripts Collection?
You mean segregating things that can be removed and discarded?
Right.
Okay. When in every collection, there are always series of transitory records, notes, things of that nature that really no longer have context.
Okay.
You no longer know what they refer to. The equivalent of a modern phone message, I think, in other words, is always found in materials like that. At the University of Missouri, one of the duties of the presidents of the 19th century were to order the books, to sign orders for pencils and desks and pen nibs, you know, ridiculous things like that. And I'm sure that's also true of the local librarian or director of the library.
Uh-huh.
Those usually are not terribly valuable.
Okay.
Also, you know, publications that are off prints that are collected, not usually very very important. Let's see, one area also that produces a lot of records without much value is things like lost books, fines, things of that nature.
Okay.
Really transitory monetary transactions are not of great value. as I say, any record that documents the making of a decision or the making of and development or implementation of a program that had staying power in the county would, in my opinion, be most worthy of saving.
Okay. Okay. Do you have anything that you would like to add before we open it up for questions?
Well, I would like to add, I guess, it's a great mystery about what happens to records from the time they're found in the wine box or the apple box in the basement until they're, you know, presented to you in acid-free file folders in historical societies or in Western or at the university archives. And it is kind of a complex procedure. It's not so complex as different from librarianship. Archives functions on two principles that are fairly distinct from libraries. One is the concept of provenance. And what that means is that materials are never mixed and rearranged according to topic. Records are always kept in groups by the creator, the office or the entity or the individual who created them, so that there is context with the records. The other concept that archivists use are original order, and that is if there is some kind of original arrangement to records when you find them, it's best to maintain them because when you maintain that original order, what you're doing is saving evidence of how those records were used, how they were consulted, how they were compiled to make a functional record series within the office. Knowing those two things, you know, then you can kind of go to searching out the natural record series, the functional groups of records in the boxes, and you begin to put an organization around these records that may not be well organized, may not be well preserved. You, in many cases, you're reestablishing a provenance, an order, a context for the records that makes them much richer and makes them much more valuable in telling the story of the institution.
For example, let me see, I want to make sure I'm understanding this. Mm-hmm. If financial records are separated from decisions made by the board and the books chosen for the Mark Twain Award and the people who served on those committees, the better way to organize that is to actually put that together rather than in a separate series, because the money spent on the Mark Twain Award is part of the budget.
The youth services type. No, I would say those are very natural
series?
Record series.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, you know, if you have children's programming in parks and recreation and you have children's programming in libraries, don't combine those materials because they're about children's programming. Keep the two groups separate according to the departments or the agencies that created them.
Okay.
So, very early on, the French tried to, during the reign of Bonaparte, tried to sort all of the state records according to topics. And the result is that even today, most 18th century French records are just almost unusable because the context has been removed.
Napoleon wouldn't be happy about that.
No, he wouldn't have been. But he moved on to another interest quickly enough.
Okay, let's see if we have anybody out there who has a question. Telephone number in Columbia is 884-3803. Or our toll-free number is 866-768-5483. Trying to think, how do you go about describing these things?
Okay. What we do first is you know, we go through and we try to identify file series, which are functional units, and we put them in the original arrangement as best we can determine,
mm-hmm.
and we describe each of those groupings, each of those file series, in a separate way, in a paragraph, and the paragraph would begin with how the records were created, what they did, and what the records, the file folders, or the units may consist of.
Okay.
And that is how you describe a file series. And that's the basic unit, really, of archival research is the file series. Anything above that, you know, subgroups and record groups, those are kind of abstract concepts and don't really matter in the arrangement of individual records that the researcher will find.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they help keep archivists straight and on course.
Okay. One more time, I'll go ahead and give the phone numbers. They just wrote up on the board that we have 8 listeners. so there is somebody out there. In Columbia, it's 884-3803. And toll-free is 866-768-5483. And we'll give it a couple of minutes, and if we don't hear from anyone, we'll call it a wrap. I'm sure you've had a long day.
Yeah. If I could go back for a moment,
sure,
and talk about some of the other really magnificent things we have in Special Collections.
Oh, you bet.
Collection. I always get kind of sidetracked by the Construcción book because it is a physical object is really so fascinating. But we have other books certainly as important or more important. One of my favorites is the Dialogues of Galileo. We have the first edition, the 1661 edition of the Dialogues. And has the what is so unusual about this is it has the original Italian pasteboard covers. Many of them have been rebound, mostly in fine leather.
Right.
And at least the ones that weren't burned. This one has, in fact, been corrected under the orders of the church. The church allowed the books that were already sold simply to be corrected rather than burned. The ones that were not sold yet were the ones that were burned. But this is, you know, this is a book written about things such as momentum and centripetal force and the like that the church interpreted as pure heresy and ended up with Galileo receiving life house arrest for its publication. It's a fantastic, you know, feeling to sit there and look at the book, to hold it in your hands.
How do you handle them when you know, something like that is so fragile that how do you store it?
Well, we store them, most of our rare books, we store them in protective boxes, clamshell boxes, that are very strong and also give a good deal of support to the books. Sometimes we just open them inside the clamshell boxes and allow it to cradle in there. We always use white gloves so that we won't deposit any skin oils on them, which will, you know, give a bit of nourishment to mildew and other microbes. But, you know, I really encourage people to come and ask for and look at these materials. We, you know, the purpose of these materials is to excite people, is to interest them. And for me, the most affirming experience I can have is when a undergraduate comes and really wants to see for themselves, you know, the copy of the Dialogues, or wants to see our copy of Vesalius, or wants to see our herbal, our 1641 herbal. Those are times when I feel that we're really being very important. One of my favorite memories is, in fact, of a young woman a year or so ago who was a freshman who kind of came into Special Collections very sheepishly and, you know, asked if we had the copy of Galileo. And I said, yes. And she said, could I see it? And I said, yes, you could. Have a seat. And I had her fill out the forms. And I went and got it and opened it and put it on the table for her and put down some gloves. And she said, you mean I can touch it?
Yeah. See, that's what I was saying. You mean you can touch these things?
So she did, you know, and I suspect probably she didn't have much Latin or any Latin. But she sat there and she was, you know, excited. She was interested because she was in the presence of this very, very historically important book.
Wow.
Yeah.
You don't happen to have any romances in your special collections, do you?
Well, actually, we do have some
really
19th century equivalents of bodice rippers. Yeah, they were, you know, we have some Victorian literature. Tame, of course, by today's standards, but romance and love were certainly big topics of the 19th century fiction market. That's, of course, one of the reasons why public librarians tried to keep fiction out of the public libraries.
Yes.
For so long, because they thought it was not morally uplifting and might even be contributing to moral degradation.
I may have to make a trip to Special Collections to take a look at those. And wow,
yeah.
The forerunner of the paperback run.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one more time, 884-3803 and 866-768-5483.
You know, we have an herbal in our collection that was put together by a physician in Germany called Leonhard Fuchs, and it was created in 1541. It was magnificent and important because not only was it a large herbal that had over 1,500 plants, but it was also the first herbal to actually picture some New World plants, like peppers and pumpkins and what else? Several squash, Indian squash. Really a nice piece. The author was not terribly imaginative, because the entire text was taken either from Galen or Diogenes or some of the ancient physicians, Pliny. He didn't have a great deal to say himself. In fact, he had nothing to say himself. But what he did is he supervised the creation of the wood blocks, and he supervised in a small number of these, ours is one of them, the actual hand coloring of every one of the illustrations. And that makes it very important. Leonhard also was the first fellow to give credit and give fame to the woodcutters and the plate colorers, the colorists, because he has wood blocks of the carvers and the colorists in the back of the book.
Interesting.
Yeah. First time that even ever been recognized, even by name, much less by portrait.
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I need a course in the history of the book, I think. Taught in Special Collections.
Yeah, it can certainly support it, there's no question. It's a very rich collection, and we've built it. It has been built by truly giants in the rare books field. We had a special collections librarian named Lehman Haupt, who was expert in rare and ancient books with, I believe it was Sotheby's or it may have been Reed's in New York. But he decided to give that up, moved to Missouri, became the special collections person, and got us very wonderful things because of his connections in New York. And later he became a professor in the library school in the early 1960s.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, well, I'll tell you what, it doesn't look like we're going to get Any? Oh, they're shaking heads. No callers.
Okay.
So I guess there are no crises in 94, 8, 9. Oh man, it is a long day. 94, 18. Other than the blog, and I may have to go home to try to solve that one. And thank you, Mike, very much for being with us this evening and giving us some pointers. And I'm sure Charlie wished that, probably hopes that he had his class listening this evening, but they can go back and pick up archives. And I think we've got other students who would find the things that you discussed very interesting. And I think that's one of the nice things about having those archives is that students can go back to them, because you never know what's going to come out of an interview, you know, when you're talking. So, again, thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, and I do invite any of the students who hear this to come up and see Special Collections or come over to Lewis Hall and see the University Archives.
I will be there as soon as I get through September.
Okay.
I want to see those romance books.
Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mike.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Okay, and we'll give it just a second in case we have somebody who has questions about class. If we need phone numbers again, 884-3803 and 866-768-5483. And if you are going to call, it is now or it's going to be never. Okay, in that case, that's all for this evening's Class Cast. Our thanks to Mike Holland for sharing his expertise with us this evening. And thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us this evening. This program will be archived on the LIS Radio website at lisradio.missouri.edu. The intro music this evening, which never got played, was from Trio with Emmylou Harris, Linda Ronstadt, and Dolly Parton, with Emmylou lending her talents to Do I Ever Cross Your Mind. We'll catch that again later sometime. At the controls this evening, our own Jennifer Crispin, who's in 9418, with background vocals from the studio audience and Judy Ritchie's reflector crowd, and I can't talk. We welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions regarding LIS Radio. Just send them to, you can send them to me at esserl@missouri.edu. And if you would include LIS Radio in the subject line so they're easy to sort out from the rest of the email, I would appreciate it. Now we leave you with Mark O'Connor and Yo-Yo Ma performing Flowers of Edinburgh. This is Dr. Linda Esser inviting you to join us on LIS Radio. Who knows what might be learned?